Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm managing editor Matt Goldberg, and with me today is associate editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
Today we'll be talking about Thor: The Dark World, and pretty much at this point, anytime a Marvel movie comes out, we feel the need to do a sort of Marvel state of, I guess, the state of Marvel. The state of Marvel every 6 months, and what are they up to? Because it's biannual, and the studio changes and develops, and every one of their movies is scrutinized, especially by us, because that's our bread and butter. So, Thor: The Dark World is the second film of Marvel Phase 2, and so far I'd say Phase 2 is not off to a bad start, but not off to a great start either. I've liked Iron Man 3. I rewatched it recently, and it's good. It's not great. It's good. Much better than Iron Man 2. And Thor: The Dark World is a first half that's really flat. First half is a lot of setup and not a lot of the characters being together in any substantial way. Yeah, Jane Foster and Thor get together a little bit more, which is nice, but you're keeping Loki in the bullpen waiting for her to unleash him. And I can pinpoint the moment that movie turns around and it becomes something fantastic. That's the thing. When the movie picks up, it really picks up. And for me, there was enough good stuff to get ahead of it, away from all the first half endless setup. And I'll let Adam talk about his feelings, but just to lay out the rest of the show, we're also going to start looking ahead to Captain America and the way Marvel is pushing it, and also other developments in Marvel land, such as their new TV series that they're planning. And we'll also talk about the end credit scene in Thor: The Dark World, and we'll let you know when to turn off when we start talking about that. So, Adam, my review is on the site. Why don't you talk a little bit about your feelings on Thor?
I mean, I guess I'm kind of like you. It was fine, and I'll say up front, I'm not the biggest fan of the Marvel slate of movies. I mean, I have a few that I really like, but I mean, I don't love the Avengers. I think it's fine. I rewatched it recently, and with Thor, it's just it's really bad. And there's fits and starts of parts of the movie that are really good, but it's just such a hodgepodge. It feels like a jumble. It feels like there wasn't, you know, one collective vision that was going forward and putting everything together. It felt like it was a constant struggle between, like, which story do we want to tell and what do we want the tone of the movie to be. I thought the comedy bits were the best parts about it, and I think that's one of the biggest post-Avengers takeaways, I think, has been the influence of Joss Whedon on Thor: The Dark World and possibly Iron Man 3. I know Iron Man 3 was pretty far along by the time Whedon was officially signed on to consult on the rest of Marvel's movies. But
and Shane Black's a pretty funny guy.
Yeah, also. And Shane Black is hilarious, but I thought the humor in this was great. Obviously, the Thor and Loki show was fantastic. I just, personally, I don't think Thor is that interesting of a character, and apparently Marvel and Alan Taylor didn't either, because he barely does anything in the first half of the movie. But I don't know, it kind of felt like a, not a TV show per se, but like a one of like Britain's like Christmas episodes or like a special. Like, it didn't really have the scope or anything. I felt like the villain was really, really lame and boring, and I understand why Mads Mikkelsen kind of dodged that one. There's really nothing to him.
Yeah,
he was a walking MacGuffin.
I was talking with some friends after I saw it a second time, and it slightly improved on second viewing, but not substantially. And they did make the point that the villain is trying to reclaim the world, that the universe used to be ruled by dark elves, and then the Asgardians stormed in, and he was kind of kicked out. So he wants all this to reclaim it for his people. That being said, you really don't see him suffering for it. You don't really see the agony. He's just sort of this mwahaha. We will take back the universe, and we will have... Like, there's no real agony there. It's not really... You don't need to sympathize with him.
Yeah. And, I mean, there were parts of the movie that I liked a lot. I thought Curse was genuinely terrifying. I thought that was a really, really great design and great use of that character. The Thor and Loki stuff was great. I really liked the Kat Dennings stuff. I thought that was really funny. Some of the comedy on Earth fell flat, but I thought her stuff was... And Chris O'Dowd I thought that was really funny and really interesting. I loved the way they, I guess the device they used for the third act set piece. I thought that was really interesting.
I like that a lot because
I thought that was really neat. But
it's
just
the only thing that could be done in a Thor movie.
Yeah. It just feels different and weird. And that's, I guess, what I was hoping for more of. But I don't know. It just, as a whole, it just feels really jumbled to me. There were parts of it that I liked a lot, but there were more parts of it that I was just kind of ho-hum about. I don't think it's an awful movie. I don't think it's a terrible movie, but it's one that I'm in no rush to rewatch or re-see or revisit.
I'll think I'll end up rewatching it. I don't think I'll rush out to buy it. Before I went to go see it a second time, I rewatched Thor because Thor is on Netflix. I don't own Thor. And I rewatched Thor, and I really liked Thor when I saw it in theaters, and then over time it's not really stuck with me. And 2 years later I'm watching it on Netflix and I'm like, this is an adequate movie.
Yeah, I have the same reaction.
For what it needs to do in terms of a larger universe, it gets the job done. It just gets it done on endless and pointless Dutch angles. If you can say nothing else for Thor the Dark World, it is at least shot better than the original Thor. At least, or at least not as distracting, at the very least.
So but still, Marvel's budgets, man, it's so annoying how cheap everything looks.
I disagree. We always have this argument, and you think everything looks cheap, and I keep that argument in my head when I'm watching those movies, and I'm not seeing it. Nothing looks cheap. I saw it in 2D. At 3D, I couldn't really tell anything because it's 3D and it looks like shit. But or doesn't, it's just pointless and I'm not really paying attention. But in 2D, yeah, I saw it really crisp and everything looked good.
It's not that it looks unbelievable or anything. It just looks like not like half-assed, but that they were like, all right, this is the budget for VFX and we're not budging. Like this is what you'll get. And I mean, especially after seeing something like Ender's Game where it's really gorgeously done and really beautiful. Like this was just kind of, it was adequate. And I thought with Alan Taylor on board, like Game of Thrones, I thought maybe it would be a little better, but it was fine. It wasn't as bad as the other ones, but like when you look at a movie like The Avengers, like that movie should blow your mind, and the effects on it are just fine. I don't think they're terrible, but they're fine.
Well,
but
I don't think it's an effect. I mean, I think it should blow your mind because I think I like the fact that it's more character driven.
Well, honestly, I think it's for me, it's more of an aesthetic thing, and we can get into this when we talk about the Marvel Universe as a whole, but I don't love that there's really no authorial stamp on any of the Marvel movies visually. They all look the same, and they all have the same aesthetic, and that's not an aesthetic that I love. It's digital. It looks like digital, I just don't love the color schemes. I don't love the way it's put together. It feels comic booky, which I guess it should, and I guess that's what Marvel's going for, but that's not kind of my thing.
Well, we can talk about it now. I think that I would agree to an extent that they do have a similar feel. What I like is that they look like they could all take place in the same universe, that there is a consistency.
Sure.
There.
And I understand that.
And
I understand that.
The other thing is that I do feel like they each, though, feel like they take place in their own universe. Iron Man is very modern. I loved the classic feel of Captain America, and Thor has a great mystical thing going on that I do feel that the worlds are distinct, but they do take place in the same world. So in a way it's universal. They all look the same, but I feel like it's in service of something, and that they don't look similar enough that each character doesn't have its own stamp, that you believe they're living in different places.
Sure. And I guess my problem probably just comes down to aesthetically. I don't love the aesthetic they've chosen, and they stick to that aesthetic because, I mean, and they should. It should all feel like it's the same world. If you had one movie that looked like Batman Begins and another that looked like The Avengers, that wouldn't really mesh well.
Well, that's the question, though. What happens when they get to Ant-Man? Because Edgar Wright has such a distinct style, and he's not a newcomer in the sense that, yes, it'll be his first movie for them, but he's been in the loop ever since 2006 with Ant-Man. He is not new. They are not just randomly bringing him on. That this is a guy who's been with them, just not had his film ready yet.
Well, I think the best looking film so far has been Iron Man 3, and that's really been the one that's directed by I don't know if you could call Shane Black an auteur, but he definitely has his own, a very specific style. And that one, the visuals of that movie felt very specific to me. It felt very crisp, and I'm hoping that's the same with Ant-Man. But I just read a few days ago, it was on Variety, that and it was someone from Marvel talking about this, how they're I forget, it's very, very technical, but they're working on a way to get color coding to standardize visually all of their films on set so that they are all, that color coding is all standardized across the board. And basically, in a way, not only to save money, but just to keep everything consistent. So, and I know color coding was the big thing, and there was something else technically with the cameras that they were doing on set, but they were basically setting a standard that, like, on every Marvel film, this is the color code that you're going to use. They said they would still leave some room for the cinematographers to, I guess, choose things and stuff, but I think they're doing color coding on set, or a portion of the color coding on set now to keep it similar. I wish I could find, if I might try and
Well,
find it later.
that's interesting to say that they're doing it now because, again, well, we're already looking ahead to Ant-Man, but what about Guardians of the Galaxy? Because that's already so out there in terms of what it is. And what, again, it's almost the memory's getting a little hazy, but when you saw it at Comic-Con, did you think it still looked the same as all the other Marvel movies, or did you feel that, wait, this is going a little bit outside the bounds visually?
For Guardians,
Yeah.
I mean, it's like aesthetically, it's tough to tell on those screens at Comic-Con, but like, I mean, you saw the stinger for Thor.
Right.
I mean, you saw what the costumes look
By
like
the
in
way, guys,
Guardians.
sorry, we're getting to the spoiler alert. The stinger relates to Guardians. All right, go on.
I'm sorry, I thought we had done that up front.
It's all right.
I guess probably if you haven't seen Thor, maybe don't listen to the rest of the podcast.
Yeah. Okay, moving on. So let's talk about the stinger.
Well, I mean, not to get into specifics, I was just saying that it's very, the costumes and the look of the characters are very, very different from what we've seen, and I like that. I liked it a lot, and it definitely, like, I got really excited about it because it looks fucking weird, and I love that. I love that it's going to be so just weird and out there.
And I think that the reason that they skipped ahead to Guardians is A, you I don't think it's easier to put a Guardians thing at the end of a Captain America movie, and there's a lot of that Guardians really exists in the Thor. Thor is next door to Guardians. So that's the best connective tissue. And B, I think that Marvel really wants more time to start building up Guardians in people's minds, because that's the only one of Phase 2 that isn't a sequel, and it has so many characters to introduce, and it's an incredibly weird world. It is probably, now that the Avengers is done, it is easily the most ambitious film of Phase 2.
Oh, yeah.
And that's including Avengers: Age of Ultron. I think that's a safe bet in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really right now, Age of Ultron, to me, the biggest question mark is Scarlet Witch, whose power is difficult to define, because in the comics, it's basically she can manipulate probability, which is very hard to show on camera that she's changing probabilities. But
But I mean, we've seen time and time again Marvel
oh,
will tweak
tweaking
and
things. No,
change.
absolutely. I'm just saying, like, how Whedon's going to do it, but I'm talking about the world, and
Yeah.
Avengers will take place in our world, presumably. Maybe it'll go beyond, but we know that Guardians is going to be weird. And if you saw the stinger, you know you have proof. We knew it at Comic-Con. We
Yeah.
knew it was going to be weird at Comic-Con. And the thing is that some people may be off-put by the stinger because it is really weird. There were some people in the comment section who didn't even realize, and the people I saw it with, they're like, "Who was that guy?" And it's
Yeah,
Benicio del Toro. They're like,
it took me a
"Oh,
minute.
yeah."
It took me a minute to realize that was who it was.
He's talking all weird, and he looks like Mugatu, and
Oh, I love it. I
it
love it.
is. And then they're setting up the Infinity. They're setting up the Infinity Gauntlet without actually ever saying Infinity Gauntlet, and they're not even
Yeah.
saying Infinity Gems. They're now stones, and the stones are mentioned in earlier in Thor: The Dark World that there are six of them, or maybe five. That's the thing. He said there's five, and then there's the ether, which is a liquid, but at the end of the film, it's not a liquid anymore. It's in a little case. And then they're not calling them red. It's weird. We don't know where they're taking it, but they're going to it. They're moving towards where they need to go. But again, so many characters, and this guy isn't even one of the Guardians. He is kind of a bad guy in this. So it's just very weird. There are going to be no people you know in it, presumably. No, I mean, there's no one going to outer space who's going to probably swing by.
I'm sure they'll have some kind of cameo. And I like how that Marvel has started to, they have to become smart with their cameos now because of the contract. So, you know, Robert Downey Jr. signed for, I think it was 6 films, and the Avengers 2 will be the end of that deal. So in
he signed for Avengers 2 and Avengers 3. Like when his big negotiation came up again, it was 2 and 3. He had used it up at the end of Iron Man 3.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, regardless, anytime an actor makes a cameo,
no,
that counts.
You're right. They use it up, and sometimes. So in Thor, they really make it worth it. There's a cameo in Thor.
Well, in Thor, they chose Chris Evans because he's only been in 2. Like he was the safe choice.
He was a safe choice, but also he really wanted to do it, which is so much like there are interviews where he's like, "Yeah, I'd really like to be in Thor," and it's like, "How is that ever going to happen? How are you ever going to be in a Thor movie?" And then apparently this was one of the reshoots that they did to add some more humor, is to throw in Chris Evans being in the movie, and it's such a great moment. It's just a little moment, but again, it's one of those things at the turn of the film that really injects a lot of life into it, sorely needed.
Alternatively, the big main scenes that they did in the reshoots were the prologue, which was useless, and the scene right after that, where Loki's in chains and comes home to Thor. Those were both added. And Alan Taylor, who has been refreshingly honest in interviews, said that he was not a fan of those. He prefers the version of the movie that didn't have that, but he said he thought the audience would be smart enough to kind of understand things without a prologue.
I heard that the ending was reshot as well. Or that it may have been. Well, see, that's a bit of a stretch.
I know
someone
the two
speculated.
That they are the first two.
I'm sorry?
I know the two scenes that Marvel has admitted to that were added, and this is what Alan Taylor said in that interview where he was being pretty honest, were the prologue and then the scene with Loki in chains where he's coming back to Asgard. And he said that he felt that they weren't necessary, that the audience was smart enough to get it, but Marvel felt that, you know, they needed that added push to explain, like, this is what the ether is, if you didn't understand it when we already explained it to you.
Yeah, that was there again. It does slow down the first half, and one of the things that I'm a little surprised at is that the ending hasn't been a little more controversial, because we're going to talk about the ending now. Basically, it's implied that Loki has killed Odin.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And I mean, or at least Odin was, I don't know, in the can at the time, and then Loki's gonna step out, like,
I think it's implied that he killed him.
He killed him.
Not only because that makes Loki a more interesting character, but also the fact that Anthony Hopkins is sleeping his way through this movie, and...
Oh, and he's, I think really he's gone on record that he's kind of bored with it and doesn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah, so.
No, I think that, I agree, but also, but it's, I mean, it makes it really kind of weird, because... Loki, on the one hand, Thor has gotten what he wanted, like Loki has given that to him, but at the same time, he is betrayed. His father is dead and Thor doesn't know it. He loves his father and his father is freaking dead.
I feel like that answers the question of how do you get another Loki story out of this, because you've done the dueling brothers and then you've done the reteaming brothers. What are you, well, now, you know, brother killed father, what happens? So
right,
I feel like that's just another motivation to bring Loki back into the fold at some point in the future.
Well, they love him, and again, that when he's really not in the fold for the first half of the movie, and when he comes in, boom, back to life. He is just,
livens it up.
He's
really great.
Does.
Tom Hiddleston is the best thing to happen in the Marvel Universe since Robert Downey Jr.
That is an excellent way of putting it. And rewatching Thor, his character is so different. He's very shy and withdrawn and secretive, but I think once he goes into the Avengers, and it makes sense, he's basically gone insane and gone power mad and feels betrayed. So it's a much bigger character at that point.
Sure. But and even in the first Thor, I thought he was fantastic.
Oh, no. I'm not saying he's bad in the first Thor. What I'm admiring is that it's a very different kind of performance, and yet the two come together. It's not like, to me, it's sort of, look at Spider-Man 2. And in the first, and look at Doc Ock, who is... He's very serious and determined. And then when he becomes a supervillain, he's like one-liners and like quips. And it's like, okay, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt and assume that one of your quippy one-liner things comes from one of your mechanical arms that's controlling you. That's the best.
It comes from the brain. He does have something attached to his brain. So
no, it's infecting his brain. No, it's bad writing. It's not bad writing. It's just jarring. And Hiddleston doesn't have that. There is a continuity there where you can see how this character became this character, because there is an underlying thing running through all of it, which is maybe this guy just needs a hug, but then he'll stab. But then he's gonna stab you in the back. So it's difficult.
Chops Thor's arm off. I would like to say that in the footage they showed at Comic-Con this year, the very end of the Thor footage was Loki chopping Thor's arm off, and the audience went crazy because we were like, "What the fuck happens in that movie?
Right.
What happens if Loki chops Thor's arm
and
off?"
And I was talking with a friend about it, and apparently she had found out about it or made the footage and like leaked online. She's like, "That's an illusion." I'm like, "No," and then, yeah, it was totally an illusion.
Yeah.
No. Well, I mean, yeah.
Well, and one thing Thor the Dark World also gave us was a lot of the criticisms of the Avengers was, what is Loki's motivation? Like, why has he decided to come to Earth? Like, what's he doing? And in my mind, it was all about him being upset with Thor over choosing a human, and why would he do that? And he's going to show him how easily you can manipulate humans. But I guess in Thor the Dark World, I think it's his mother who explicitly states that he wanted to be king of something because he got passed over.
I think that's clear in Avengers. He's like, I'm a king. I was a king. That need to rule is very big in Avengers and Thor the Dark World. Like that.
See, I didn't get it at all. And
there are some lines in. I mean, there's multiple lines. He's like, here's at one point Robert Downey Jr. or Iron Man tells Loki, it's like, you're not getting it. There is no throne here. You don't seem to understand. And it's that kind of thing, and or just like, you will kneel before me. It's very much the need to be a ruler of something. And he can't rule Asgard, so now he's going to rule Earth.
Sure. Well, and also, speaking for Rene Russo, I thought the female characters in Thor were very well drawn, and I enjoyed that. And
I was so happy she had something to do in this movie.
Exactly, and there was no really damsel in distress. And
really, I did feel like Jane Foster was in more distress now. She was literally infected with Earth-ruining ether. I mean, she was really in distress. I mean, she eventually got saved and got
She's
to
a
do
damsel,
her part.
But she wasn't this like, oh, I'm so helpless.
Oh, she wasn't
like,
a wilting
flower. She was very,
flower.
Very smart, and she was like telling them, like, she figured out. She's the one who figures out what to do at the end, like how.
Yeah.
To,
again, like I'm not saying like this film is bad to women. I really like Meredith Borders on Badass pointed this out, and she's totally right. It's a great scene where Jane Foster throws herself over Thor when the thing's coming down. Like, that's possibly going to affect, but like, it doesn't matter. Like, that's her instinct, is to protect
Absolutely.
Him.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
I thought that was really nice. And to me, their relationship really strengthens in this film to the point where I believe it. And at the end of the first movie, I think Devin put it best, where at most you buy it that these are two people who'd want to make out a lot. Like, it's not love at this point. It's just they want to make out, and like that.
They're dating.
They're dating. Not like, I will come back for you.
In this movie, they've decided to go full on relationship,
which is good because there's enough room there for. And that's the thing, in terms of throughout all the setup, at least there's a little bit of. It's like you're saying, it's on and off. I don't think the first half is completely without merit. I just think.
I like Chris O'Dowd a lot.
Yeah, he had a good. He had a couple. He had some good scenes. So many. he's great. Yeah, Chris O'Dowd is a lot of fun, and it's one of those things where it's kind of a reminder where you hear it's like Chris O'Dowd's going to be in Thor, and you don't really know in any capacity. And it's a very small role, but it's a good one.
Well, I saw this with my girlfriend, and after it ended, she was like, that was a silly movie. She was like, that wasn't a bad movie, but it's very silly. And she said that that's something you can only do in Thor movies, and it's because the characters are so outlandish and so otherworldly that you can bring these human characters in to kind of ground it and say, like, what the fuck? Like, to comment on, like, this, just the outlandishness of what's happening in people in the world. Like, when they come back at the end and Kat Dennings is like, were you at a party? Like, were you in a costume?
Well, the moment, and again, we're already at spoiler talk or whatever. So, but we
put the spoiler warning down 15 minutes ago, Matt.
I know. I just want to be clear with people. But when Thor,
after we've already spoiled the ending. Of the
I
movie.
Know, right? Look, people. I know we spoiled the ending, but I'm going to tell you other parts of the movie that you would obviously know. When Thor hangs Mjolnir on the coat rack.
Yeah.
It's little moments like that that just work so
or
well.
Or when it flew by and Kat Dennings went meow meow
meow meow. it's really good. It's a lot of fun at that point, and that's the thing. I think there's enough there to make it an acceptable, slightly above adequate. It is better than the first Thor, but we're not at Amazing yet, and I'm holding out a lot of hope for Captain America. I'm hearing some good things about it, and I think this is one where it'll have a very clear identity by virtue of genre. Like Iron Man and Thor are very character driven in a way. Like, they have their universes, but what genre are they? Are they, I guess, they're action movies, really, when you boil it down.
I'd say Thor's a fantasy film.
Thor 2
is a fantasy film.
It's a fantasy film, but there's so much of it just in London, and, you know, there is fantasy in it, but not in the way I normally... It's also, there's a huge sci-fi part of it. It's like Magitek. I thought it was an interesting production design. That's really what held my interest through a lot of the first half.
Yeah, it was interesting, and it was interesting looking. Someone commented on the fact that they flew all the way to Iceland to film some of the scenes on the Elven homeworld when Thor and Loki and Jane get there. And they were like, they flew all the way to Iceland to film that, and it looks like it could have been filmed on a soundstage because they just replaced the entire background with CG.
Yeah, that's
like,
weird.
It
definitely...
Like, I would fly all the way to Iceland to, like, basically just use the dirt.
Yeah, that is weird. I mean, there are other movies that are shot in Iceland, but they use all of Iceland.
Yeah, like Oblivion.
Oblivion, I know that Noah has used Iceland effectively, presumably, for what they're trying to do. And that, I didn't even know the thing about Thor in Iceland. Yeah, that's, and we're talking about Marvel trying to save money and not be cheap, and that seems like a pretty poor expense. In any case, I feel that those two movies are very much like, we're Marvel movies and we're this, but Captain America's like, this is our genre. Like, this is basically a political thriller, but it happens to have a superhero in it. Like,
it's based on the trailer.
Based on the trailer, and based, again, what I've heard and what they're going. I mean, even I think some of the, either the directors have said it, or someone has said it, that this
I think
is,
Kevin Feige said it was he categorizes it as a political thriller.
Right, and I think it's going to work really well. I like the trailer a lot. Also, I think of the Avengers right now, Captain America is kind of my favorite. I like just his... I think Chris Evans is great at it. I like his attitude. I still like his line from the first movie where he's like, so you want to go kill Nazis? Like, no, I just don't like bullies. Like, that, just like that, boiling it down. And somebody's like, it's a simple character. And I'm like, it's simple, but it works. Like, it's just... I understand he's uncomplicated, but is that the worst thing ever? He's a good... It is. He's a good guy. He's just a good guy. And I like that. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being silly. But in a world where Batman is brooding all the time and everything is miserable, I like the guy that just stands up. And I think in Captain America, the Winter Soldier, yeah, he'll get more complicated, but really it's his values running up against the world rather than something dark brooding inside of him.
That's what I'm most interested to see in that is the dichotomy between a man from the 40s looking at the state of the world now and the state of how our government works, and I hope they really go for it. I mean, there's that line in the trailer where he says, this isn't freedom, this is fear. And I hope that Marvel doesn't shy away from, like, we don't want to be political, we don't want to do anything. But I think you don't even have to be political. Just, I mean, how would a man from the 1940s, Chris Evans, react? You don't have to take a stance on it. Just show how that would play out. Like, what would his arguments be, and what would his government be?
Yeah, and of course it'll be in the sense in a cool sense of if the 1940s were tolerant. He's not going to come around. He's like, what's with all these women being out of the kitchen?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
He's not going to do that. He's talking about American values in the sense of someone being rah-rah. A guy who basically was selling war bonds, selling the idea of America at its best. So really, someone who has always held an ideal, and not, I mean, beyond America, just being good. I think that's just in him, and I think you're right that it could carry over, but it's the whole 1940s dichotomy thing, and I think it's going to work really well. I'm really excited for it, and I think of really of all the Phase 1 movies, Captain America, The First Avenger, is I like that one a whole lot. I really like that movie.
That's a lot of people's favorite. I'm in the minority. That's one of my least favorite.
That's just because you hate America.
Basically, yes. I just, again, I can't get over that. This is the most digitally looking movie of all the Phase 1 movies.
I disagree. I just don't.
I know.
We
know
have a
disagree.
Visual eye. We have a visual. I don't watch. Wait. By the way, people know that Adam is colorblind, right? So his
that
opinion
has
is.
To do
you're
with
colorblind. You don't know shit.
Yes, I see everything.
If you knew
black
what
and white.
The colors were, you would appreciate it. That's all
oh,
I'm saying.
I'm sure. It's not the motion blur when they're fighting in World War II that bugs me. No, that can't be it.
No, it's because you can't see colors. All right.
I am very interested, though, and, you know, the directors of Captain America come from TV and are the Russo brothers, and I'm not expecting, like, a super strong authorial voice on that one, but I'm probably most excited for Guardians of the Galaxy, but I'm most interested in man to see if it looks like an Edgar Wright movie. Does it feel like an Edgar Wright movie? What does a Marvel movie look like through the eyes of someone like that? I mean... Shane Black is a brilliant filmmaker, but he
that was
had
only his second movie.
Yeah, that was only his second movie. So Edgar Wright has a very, very specific style, not only visually, but also, you know, writing his screenplays. And I'm really, really interested to see how that plays out because, yeah, I guess, was it Christopher Markus and Stephen McFeely were brought back in to work on Thor 2. They've kind of worked on three of the Marvel movies now, and it kind of seems like they have an in-house kind of script doctoring team that kind of works to smooth out, not to homogenize all of their movies, but, you know, they've got their guys that they like that can keep everything in line. And I understand that this is supposed to be one cohesive universe, that all of the movies should be taking place in the same universe. I just kind of, I don't know, I'd like to see more leaps being taken, more risks being taken. And that's where Guardians, man, if they let James Gunn just go batshit crazy, that's going to be amazing.
And so far, from if you combine what we saw at Comic-Con with the stinger, they
yeah.
have. They
yeah.
really have, in a way
I
that...
I feel like they probably feel like this isn't Superman, this isn't Iron Man. People aren't going to like be up in arms if we mess this one up.
Well,
like this is
yeah,
no one knows what Guardians is, so just make it whatever you want. There's no one has an instinctive idea of what Guardians of the Galaxy should be.
It's also perfectly timed because the next movie is Avengers 2, and you're never going to turn anyone off of Avengers 2. Whereas
absolutely,
if you
yeah.
brought in Guardians earlier in Phase 2, people are like, okay, I don't know what they're doing here anymore.
Yeah.
You've shaken me. I don't know what you guys are doing from here on out, but now I'm a little tepid. If you put this at the end of Phase 2 or right before Avengers, you're right, it doesn't matter. Because people are still going to show up. They're interested. It's still going to be a tough sell, though. It's going to be a very tough sell to get people in, but you're hoping that the goodwill from all the other Marvel movies... But this is going back to what I was saying, where I think this is going to get a much earlier push, because even James Gunn was saying that we can expect to start seeing something very soon for this movie.
Yeah,
they've
got to get the word out.
I think we're going to see a poster very soon, maybe a very brief, I wouldn't say a teaser, but we're probably going to start seeing some posters, official stuff coming out down the line. I mean, and I think you can obviously time this stuff based on how Captain America was timed in front of Thor, because you got the first Captain America trailer, what, 6 months, 5 months before Thor. You got, you know, right before Thor came out, you got your Captain America trailer. So that's 5 months before the movie comes out.
Well, and this is also 2013 is the first year that two Marvel movies have come out in the same year. They're on an expedited schedule, so they have to get these trailers out because it's normal time for what it would have been before. We've just seen another Marvel movie. And what was it, 2015? They originally had movies scheduled for April and May, which was insane.
That was
for
insane.
May and June. It was May and June. They were, and we later found out that the June one was Ant-Man and May was Avengers 2. But it was like, what are you doing?
And now, now they're just going to do May and July. And they were going to have Ant-Man in November. And then James Bond is like, I don't fucking think so. And Ant-Man fled. It fled as it wisely should.
Yes, yes.
Even though Ant-Man may have a bit of a little spy stuff in him too. I don't know. It's weird how that one might go. It's whatever they're going to do with that. And well, I don't know. That's one of the things I've heard about Ant-Man, one of the ideas of it, but who knows what they're going to do with it. And that's what makes it exciting. But already, I think just this conversation, and I know that we're all excited for Marvel movie, or I am, Adam doesn't give a shit, but excited for Marvel movie.
Yeah, I'm excited. I enjoy Marvel movies.
Okay.
I don't love them as much as other people
I guess,
do. It's not the...
Yeah. But we're getting very ahead of ourselves, and I think that's... If there is something that bothers me, it's teaser culture, which is such a weird thing to say because that's what we traffic in. This is in a big way. I mean, we go to set visits to tell people about what this movie is going to be, and we go on the set, and sometimes you go on sets and they're like, we can't tell you anything about this movie. Like, are you fucking kidding me? I came down, it's like, we can't show you. Or I went to the set visit for Ride Along almost a year ago, and they showed us the scene, and it was clearly near the end of the movie. And so I get my email telling us about, the embargo is going to lift. You can't tell people what you saw. You can tell them about the interview, but you can't tell them about the footage. It's like, okay, we didn't get to go on set. You sat us in front of a monitor all day watching the same scene over and over and over again, and we can't tell anybody about it. Okay. And we went with it. We went with it. But it's weird. The point I'm making is that it is strange. And then there are other sets where they're very open with you and tell you lots of stuff and show you lots of stuff. But all in all, it's a weird thing that all culminates with this teaser culture. And I was remarking on it in my Captain America articles, where I was saying this heavy, the Captain America marketing really ramped up in a big way, and Thor hadn't even opened yet. I wasn't talking about like a teaser poster. Like, we got the teaser poster and like a set photo pretty early on in production. And then right before Thor came out, it was Captain America trailer, Captain America poster. And I understand that the trailer comes out attached to Thor, but they released it like 2 weeks before. It wasn't just like the week of release. It was already getting ahead of it. And this is for Captain America, a film that isn't a difficult sell like Guardians is. So
sure.
That's my issue is, and again, so what we're doing now is like, what's going to happen with Ant-Man? And at this point, it's like, let's talk about Doctor Strange. And what about Black Panther? Oh my God. You think Hulk's coming back? Oh my. Like, it's just.
Well, and I know this summer, everyone at Comic-Con, everyone was expecting Marvel to, they've announced release dates through 2017 now, 2017, I think. And everyone was expecting them to reveal what those movies were. And Feige said, no, you will reveal those in a year's time. So I guess at next Comic-Con, they will tell us what those movies are, and I think it's very, very safe to bet that Doctor Strange will be directly after Ant-Man or something after Ant-Man. But also, I mean, okay, now Marvel has done sequels to Thor, Captain America, and two sequels to Iron Man. I think they go from here. It feels like Iron Man is going to be taking a break probably
because Robert Downey Jr. only has 2 and 3. We're not going to see
contracts.
Iron Man 4. That's out.
Sure, sure. Do you think one of these two sits it out? I feel like if one of them sits it out, it's Thor. I don't think they.
Loki's really popular. That's the thing. Tom Hiddleston is a big bullet in the gun, and
the Loki movie.
Really, I think it's tough to say. I think they'll look at the box office receipts to see which one is more successful, which one has the better reaction. Maybe a Guardians sequel. That's the thing. Guardians hasn't had a second movie yet, and then I think, based on popularity and based on the ability to probably get it right, it's might see another Hulk. Like a Hulk film's like, we've got the right guy. We've got the character. People are, we finally got the formula right.
Just please the origin story. Just he is Hulk. Please,
oh no, don't. No, there will be no origin story. There will be no origin story. It's completely
unnecessary.
And I mean, it was one of those bullshit Latino review rumors way back when. It's like, it's all going to be about World War Hulk. It's going to be about Planet Hulk leading into World War. It's like, no.
Nope.
God damn it. I got in trouble with those guys earlier this week because I called them greedy and not real fans. And, ooh. Well, I mean, that was harsh on my part. I've been so good for a few years now about not picking fights, but all this rumor stuff puts me in a foul mood. It really does. Just this cravenness for any scrap of information. And the reason I said greedy is because you were in the room when Superman Batman was announced. And you saw how that crowd just fucking lost their mind.
The girls behind us started crying. Literally started crying afterwards. They were like hyperventilating. It was insane.
Exactly. Now that's not good enough. Is Dick Grayson going to be in it? Is Wonder Woman going to be in it? It's like, motherfucker, why?
That's the culture we live in.
Exactly, and that bothers me so much. It just, gets to me, and then I say they're not really fans, because what you're doing is you're either depriving them of the surprise or you're building up expectations that'll never be. So let's say Wonder Woman isn't in the movie. Let's say that this actress they're screen testing for is just the female lead. Well, then everyone's going to go, and it's like, well, there's no Wonder Woman. There's no Wonder Woman. I was hoping there'd be Wonder Woman. I thought there's going to be Wonder Woman. And so now you're disappointed, or you're getting out ahead of something so far in advance that you're creating an idea of what it should be, and you're letting it percolate. It's like, motherfucker, just let the marketing take care of it. Why? If Wonder Woman is in the movie, they got you covered. So it's one of those things where it's like, what good does knowing it now do you? If something is official, right, if it's not rumored, like Star Wars, about script changes, if Michael Arndt leaving and J.J. Abrams and Lawrence Kasdan coming in, that's means something. That means something for release date. That means something for tone. That means something about the production. There's a lot of speculation involved, but it's business. We can learn something from this. What do you learn from, and this is obviously a tangent and a huge rant on my part, but I would like to talk to someone about it.
So you're saying we should now start discussing Adam Driver as Nightwing. That's what the rest of the podcast is about.
Okay, I did think that was pretty funny.
I think that's great.
When I saw that, I mean, and honestly, I think it kind of does line up with Latina reviews. Like, they're looking for a young John Hawks type. And I'm like, eh, I can see it. I can kind of see it with Adam Driver. Kind of lanky, a little odd looking, still endearing. Oh, gosh. I can't wait for...
But that's DC.
It is DC.
You're getting on a tangent.
That is, we are on a tangent, but and just to take it a little step further, Adam, I can't wait. And I can't wait for everyone to see Adam Driver in Inside Llewyn Davis. It's not a big role, but oh my god, it is so funny.
Oh, I'm a ginormous fan of his. So
I know, and he was great in The F Word. So people who haven't, look for that in 2014. What were we talking about? Right, Marvel movies.
Do you know they've announced release dates for 2016, 2017. Do you think they know what those are, or do you think that they're waiting to look at box office receipts to say, let's pencil in Cap 2 for that?
I don't think they know what they are. I think they're just staking out a claim.
Okay, because I know that they have like a script laboratory, because that's where all those rumors about Black Panther and blah 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 came forward, because Drew Pearce said that he's seen a script for I can't remember something. It might have been Black Panther, which is to say that Marvel, it doesn't mean that Marvel is planning a Black Panther movie right now. It means that
it's a laboratory. They test things, they experiment.
Yeah,
they're
exploring,
see if there's an idea, if there's something that could make a movie there.
Kind of like Pixar, yeah.
Right. But so yeah, which I think is a good idea, and it to me, when we will compare it to DC, look at Marvel, look how much they have their shit together, so much they can have a laboratory to figure this shit out. Whereas DC,
we haven't even talked about their Netflix deal yet.
Oh my god, they made a deal with Netflix. We're 42 minutes into this podcast. I totally forgot about that. I don't even know what to make of it.
Basically, they're trying to take over the world. But Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. sucks balls, so...
I didn't see it. Was there a new episode? There was a new episode. It was slight. It was
I haven't watched, like, the last three.
I told you I'm staying with it through sweeps. And the most recent episode I saw was a little bit better. That's the thing. It's getting marginally better.
I will watch the Thor episode, the episode that deals with the aftermath of Thor, and I'll check in then and see if there are any characters that are mildly interesting.
Well,
yet.
There was at least some conflict in the last episode where the team was in danger in a way that there was actual... that you saw some human emotion from them that made you understand that they cared about each other in a substantive way. It wasn't groundbreaking. It didn't blow my mind. But it was like, we are slowly possibly turning a corner. It may not turn it fast enough, but again, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. feels like a film, or I'm sorry, a series that is heavily compromised for the network that it is on.
TV, I disagree. I feel like it's heavily compromised from Marvel's
How
point
do you
of
feel
Marvel,
it is compromised by Marvel
because
when it
Disney,
has so little
Marvel
stuff
Disney,
in it?
No, not like that, but by like, this is the kind of show that we want. This is what we want it to look like. I feel like Marvel is running the show there, not ABC. And I mean, clearly it's on ABC, but I feel like Marvel
Disney
has never
runs been... Marvel, and Disney owns ABC. And I think, not that Marvel doesn't have clout, but I think that there is some sort of agreement in place that someone said to Marvel, this is how it's done on network television. okay?
I think that Marvel is so OCD about every single one of their properties and micromanages everything. There's no way they hand that show over to ABC.
I'm not saying they handed it over to ABC, but what they, I think that, yes, they micromanage, but this is their first TV series. And if someone said this is the landscape, and if you want to have a successful TV show on network television, we express, you know, we appreciate your vision, but this is how it works here. Okay, shows like Lost are rare, Heroes was canceled after a few seasons, and people on network television want procedurals. They want to be able to drop in and drop out. That's what they want, and you're pushing a very bold concept, and this is the only way you're going to ease people into it. It's very formulaic, and I don't think Marvel, you know, even if you're saying, I don't know, I feel like...
My problem isn't that it's formulaic, and I don't think I don't think that anyone thought it wouldn't be a procedural. I think that's how it should be and what it should be. But there's procedurals that can be genuinely compelling or interesting, and that's because they have interesting characters.
I agree, but what I'm saying is, and again, I think Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is default for that, and I'm saying that it is not a daring show in the way that it could be. Obviously, you need baseline characters no matter what. But what I'm saying is that it's a very safe show, and to lead into what we were talking about now with the Netflix deal, I think the Netflix deal says you're going to have a lot more creative freedom here.
I would hope so. I'm really interested to see what that...
And that's what I'm talking about. I think that the creative freedom that a network television show allows is less than what a Netflix show's allowed.
Sure, sure. And again, I'm interested. I mean, Netflix's deals have been, House of Cards have been very director-driven. House of Cards with Fincher kind of crafting that entire show, and Jinji Cohen on Orange is the New Black, which have both been the better for it.
And
they
Arrested,
have a very
and Arrested
strong...
Development with Mitch Hurwitz.
Yeah.
You didn't like, but it was creator driven. That's my point. It's creator driven.
Sure. Yes. And it's there's a very strong authorial voice in those shows. And I'm hoping that Marvel chooses someone to do each of these new shows and says, run with it. Like, this is your show. Do it. I guess they probably do have to fit into a larger cinematic universe.
Well, wouldn't it be great if they got Joe Carnahan back to do that?
That would be fantastic.
But Joe Carnahan actually launched another show, and I forget what it was. He's the
Blacklist. He's the principal. He's an executive producer on it. He directed the pilot.
Oh, man, and that's now... Man, I like everything that guy does. The Blacklist is one of... I know it's nothing groundbreaking, but I really like that show.
It's good. Because of James Hader and because of the central kind of serial aspect of it. They're enough to keep that show really compelling. It's good.
It has a nice format, and there's a nice overarching mystery that's keeping me interested week to week.
Exactly.
That's a well-made show. Unlike Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which...
Even something like Elementary, it's a solid procedural because, you know, the two lead characters are interesting, and they have...
The only reason I don't watch Elementary is because Sherlock exists, and it's like, after that, what's the point?
Sure. Well, I was... I watched the pilot, and I was like, this... asshole show, because I knew that originally CBS approached Stephen Moffat and was like, we want to do an American version of Sherlock, and he was like, I'm too busy right now. He's like, ask me in a few years. 6 months later, he reads in the trades that CBS is moving forward with a Sherlock Holmes show set in modern day, and Stephen Moffat was none too pleased.
Yeah, if you don't get to it, look, how do you think Bill Willingham feels about I think ABC at one point wanted to adapt Fables, and guess what? They have a little show called Once Upon a Time. Because guess what? All those characters are public domain, and they don't need your approval.
When are the Netflix movies or Netflix shows supposed to debut? 2014?
2015.
15.
The year of apocalypse.
Oh, God. So they've got a while to pull things together.
I don't want to go to Comic-Con next year. I didn't want to go. I don't want to go for the next 2 years, because I'm sure 2015 will have its... There'll be that second half. There's going to be the Star Wars stuff at 2015 Comic-Con. Oh, my God. Why? You know what, Adam? You know what? Let's just stop the podcast and go line up now. We're going to go line up outside the Hilton Bayfront.
And I know we shouldn't complain. Listeners, you have to understand that the lines at Comic-Con have gotten absolutely out of control, and we were just kind of last year anticipating what the lines for all the 2015 stuff next year will look like, and it's going to be bad. But at the end of the day, we're going to Comic-Con, so it's
also
fine.
Also keep in mind that it's fine, and again, as people who don't have to pay for our ticket, hotel, or badge, Although, if you do all those things, you got to want it really bad. So you're definitely going to go stand in line.
Yeah, and I applaud those people. And
I applaud those people. That's your, like, family. I was talking with
really good panels.
Yeah, I when I interviewed Chris Hardwick, and I was telling him, like, what a great moderator he is, he was saying, like, how he feels like a big responsibility up on that stage, because for some people, this is like their family vacation. This is what they save up for and go to all year. So, yeah, we don't mean to, like, bitch and whine. It's just as people who are trying to do their jobs and have to get into that hallway to do... Because if we don't get in a Hall H, we're not going to... That's going to be very bad for us as employees. So that's sort of one of our major concerns. But let's just put that out of our minds. Marvel TV shows. I said what I thought. Do you have any thoughts on the Marvel TV shows, Adam?
I mean, I've been out of the country, so I was gone when it broke. I only know, like, the very basics of it, so I haven't heard much about it. I'm just, well, I'm interested to see how they move forward with it, if they, you know, get directors to do each series, if the same director is going to do every episode of each series, because each series is one season long, correct?
Right. To those who are listening who haven't known, okay, so Marvel and Netflix teamed up. What they've decided to do is 4 13-episode seasons that will lead up to a mini series called The Defender. Each season will focus on a different hero. They all live in the same area. So season one is Daredevil, and then we don't know what the next three is, but the other three characters are Luke Cage, Iron Fist, and Jessica Jones. So each of them would get their own season, and it's a little unclear if they would cross over throughout the seasons, but the idea is that they will all team up together for a mini series after all the four seasons are over, called The Defenders, and we don't know how long that miniseries would be, but that is the plan that they are going for. But I absolutely agree, it depends on who your showrunner is, who do you get to do this. Although Matt Patch has pointed out on Twitter, because this series is supposed to take place in Hell's Kitchen, and he's like, if it's present day Hell's Kitchen, their biggest problem is going to be getting a table at a restaurant. Like, it's, if it were 1970s Hell's Kitchen, it would be a very different show. And maybe it will be, because that's grittier. It's much grimmer. It's and actually, I think that's what Carnahan's vision was for Daredevil, like a Death Wish kind of thing.
Yep. But going back to the whole script laboratory thing, I'm sure they've got I'm sure they've got scripts existing for these shows to pull from, and storylines already in place. I mean, that's where Marvel's laboratory comes in handy, because if they do say, like, hey, like, they've been working on a feature film script for Daredevil or whatever.
Well, they've been working for all four of these characters at some point have had movies in development. Like, Melissa Rosenberg, who wrote the Twilight films, was at one point attached to write an adaptation of Alias. Alias is the one, or AKA Jessica Jones. That was going to be the movie.
Yeah.
And then there's a Luke Cage movie has been in development forever. Iron Fist has been in development forever. And I think it was Bob Iger said that these are characters that we just can't give a feature film to. And I mean, it is a crowded slate, but they're characters that are worth using. And I think this is very exciting to put them on television. I think this is way more exciting than Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. had potential. It's not living up to it. I think, yes, these will be bigger stakes on Netflix, but I think it could also be a much greater reward.
Sure, yeah. I agree. And it'll be interesting to see if they pull characters up from the ranks. Like, obviously in casting, if their plan is to eventually mesh this into the Marvel Cinematic Universe in one way or another, casting, they have big actors in mind, and TV has been a haven lately. You know, we've seen a ton of great actors flocking to television. I mean, McConaughey and Harrelson went to HBO to do the season-long
talk about high expectations for a show.
Exactly, that looks fantastic. But yeah, I mean, I don't think they'll have too tough a time getting some really good actors for these shows.
Yeah. So I think that's the state of Marvel. Have we missed anything, or do you want to move to recommendations?
I'm sure there's something, but it's a big,
there's always
it's
something.
A big universe.
It is a big universe. So let's get on to recommendations. Adam, what do you got?
I'm recommending something wholly different from Thor the Dark World, and I'm recommending it because it just expanded wide this weekend. It's 12 Years a Slave. I'm sure you've heard of it, and I've heard a lot of people talking about how tough to watch it is, and how awful to watch it is, and what a... to watch it, and it is devastating, but please, please see this movie. It's, if you're unaware, it's a true story. It's based on a true story. It's based on an autobiography of a man named Solomon Northup, who in 1841 was kidnapped in Washington, D.C. He was a free black man, had a lovely family, had a life in the North, was kidnapped and sold into slavery for 12 years in the South. And this is kind of a chronicle of his life there as told by him. So the events that happen in this film are things that happened to him. And it is brilliantly directed by Steve McQueen, who also did Hunger and Shame. And the performances are astounding. Chiwetel Ejiofor in the lead is incredible. Lupita Nyong'o, a young newcomer, shines over this crazy ensemble cast. Michael Fassbender is menacing and complicated and conflicted. It's fantastic. And you deter you with people telling you that it's tough to watch. It is a little hard to watch, but it's one of the most powerful film experiences I've ever sat through. It is insanely well made, and it's something that I feel like it should be required viewing. Everyone should have to see this movie. I think that it's something they should, you know, sit high schoolers down and in an auditorium, make them check their phones, turn all the lights out, and just have to sit and experience this, because it's a really, really powerful story. And it's told unflinchingly by Steve McQueen. He does not shy away from showing anything. When I was talking with someone, and they were saying how glad they are that Steven Spielberg didn't make this movie. And it's something we haven't seen before, because it's McQueen just takes such a fantastic look at it without – he doesn't revel in anything. He doesn't exploit anything. It's nothing is done for shock value, but nothing – none of the edges are smoothed off. It's as it was and as it should be. So please – a movie theater near you, make an effort to go see this. It's going to be all over the award circuit. It's going to win a lot of things, so you will be the better for having seen it.
I agree. I would also like to point out, just to hop on 12 Years a Slave, and maybe we'll discuss it more in depth, but two of the reactions, because the praise for it has almost been universal, and the two things that I've been reading about it that sort of jumped out at me is, for Vulture, there was an article, and I mean, it had some food for thought. I didn't agree with it, but that its depiction of slavery is that the only films that are taken seriously by Hollywood involving black people are ones where black people are suffering, and those are the only ones that get paid attention to. And reading over her argument, there are some things I completely disagree with, and I won't go into detail. And one that I found more interesting was from Wesley Morris, who, for people don't know, he won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism and is only one of two or three people who have won it for film criticism. And his review of 12 Years a Slave was incredibly positive. But the thing that he pointed out that I thought was really amazing is that this is a movie where white people don't say, like, it's not about white people. Really. I mean, if you look at Amistad or Glory or a lot of movies where it's really more about black people through the lens of a white person. That's usually the way we see it. It's all about, it's not from within an African-American perspective. And that's not just having to do with the director. I mean, that's literally where the characters come in. And so I thought that was a really interesting observation.
It's like saying white audiences won't respond to this unless they have someone to go through.
So exactly. Unless
we need to have the case with 12 Years.
No, you're not going to get that, white people. Sorry.
No.
Sorry, you're not going to get
it. I can really connect to Paul Dano's terrible character.
I thought you were going to say Michael Fassbender.
No. That's too far. I couldn't go that far. Or even Sarah Paulson. God,
I was going to say, so I connect with Sarah Paulson because I like to throw decanters.
Yeah.
God. Yeah, anyway.
It's wonderful, though.
It is. It's a fantastic movie. I'm going to recommend something a little more lighthearted. I watched it this weekend for the first time. I've been meaning to watch it forever. I'm recommending 1923's Safety Last, starring Harold Lloyd. Comedy, good comedy, is timeless. This is a film that came out 90 years ago, and it is still painfully funny. It is a silent film, and yet the subject is still relatable. It's about a guy who's named the boy in the credits, and that's really, there are names for these characters, but then the credits, like the boy, the girl, the cop, the floor manager, or floor walker. And the plot is, this boy has gone to make his fortune in the city and will send for his fiancée when he's rich. It's not going well for him. He's a beleaguered clerk in a fabric shop. and he doesn't like his job, and he's trying to get to his job on time, and it's stuff we can still relate to. He's trying to get to his job on time, and he might be late. How is he going to get to his job? He's overworked, and his boss is a jerk, so how is he going to dodge his boss and keep his job? He wants to impress his fiance, so there's a farcical aspect. When she comes and visit, he needs to make himself look important, but he's not, so how is he going to dance around all that? And then the most famous scene is where he has to climb up a building as part of this stunt to promote the store, and he's hanging off the thing. This is all happening. There's no CG or green screen or even back, like, oh gosh, what is it? Rear projection. There's none of that. He is hanging from a very tall height, and you're just wondering, it's like, wow, he is gonna die for laughter. It's just, it's amazing. The moves he does, and it's something where I need to look behind the scenes and learn more, because what he's doing is phenomenal, and I can't imagine, like, some of the things he does, he couldn't have just been facing death. That, like, there had to be a scaffolding or something to prevent him from dying, because the moves and how close he comes to falling off the building, your heart is in your throat. It's just, oh my god, it's just something that can't be done today. Just not, unless it's a Jackie Chan movie, I guess, because really, because no one's gonna do that anymore. We don't even have stuntmen; we have CGI stuntmen. That's who we throw around now, and so there's something that's drained from it. But just from a comedy perspective, it is great, and it's not just slapstick; it's not just farce. Those are in there, but it's just jokes, just good jokes in a silent movie. I mean, there's some title cards that are really funny, and visual gags that one point there's all the. By the way, there is no shortage of haughty women in Safety Last. Everyone who goes to visit the fabric store is a haughty woman, and at one point he's trying to, like, this old lady in the back is trying to get her attention, and he can't reach her because there's all this crowd of women just crowding around him. He goes, "Someone dropped a $50 bill on the floor," and everyone crouches down but the old woman. He's like, and he throws her her fabric sample. It's just great. It holds up. It's 90 years later, and that's amazing, and you should totally see Safety Last. It's on Hulu Plus. It's also a part of the Criterion Collection, and right now it's Barnes & Noble's biannual 50% off all Criterion titles, so I believe that is $20 on Blu-ray. The restoration is amazing. So Safety Last, can't recommend it anymore. I have no idea what we'll be discussing next week. This is all crazy. We've all been doing so much travel, but we'll figure it out. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, what is your handle?
At Adam Chitwood.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.